Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Good afternoon. Y'all may be seated. Good afternoon. My name is Gisella Triana. I'm the senior judge here on the Third Court of Appeals. I'd like to welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals along with Justice Lopez Theofanis and Justice Crump. We thank you for being here today. I'm going to go ahead and call cause number 3-24-30-CV. This is Sandra Green, cross appellant. Sandra Green appellant versus City of Austin appellee, as well as City of Austin cross appellant versus Sandra Green appellee. If I could have y'all please go ahead and make your announcements. Let me know that you are ready and who you're representing.
My name is Mike Truesdell, and I represent Sandra Green.
Thank you. Are y'all ready to proceed?
Ola Tulip, and I'm the attorney for the City of Austin.
Okay, before we start, let me do just a couple of house clearing kind of stuff. We are currently live on our website, YouTube. It will be posted on our website if y'all want to go and watch yourselves and us afterwards, and it will be there for the remainder of eternity, I'm sure. Also, I have been told that we are splitting the time, and I believe, Mr. Truesdell, you're going to start off with 10 minutes, is that correct? And then, Mr. Matula, you will have 15 minutes to respond as well as do your cross appeal, is that correct? And then, Mr. Truesdell, you will rebut as well as respond to Mr. Matula for 10 minutes. And then finally, Mr. Matula, you will have a 5-minute rebuttal. Is that everybody's understanding? Okay, great. So we have these little colored lights right in front of me. If you're green, you're good to go. If it's yellow, that means you've got a couple of minutes left. And then if it's red, it means your time is up. If you're in mid-sentence, please finish your sentence, finish your thought. And especially if you're answering one of our questions, please go ahead and finish, and we'll wrap up after that. Okay, any questions? Okay, Mr. Truesdell, you may proceed.
Thank you, and before I start, I just wanted to take a personal note and thank this court, thank Mr. Kyle and opposing counsel for running through the fire drill about potentially having to reschedule this argument. That was tremendously appreciated by everybody, and I'm very grateful. It's an honor to be in this court, and I thank you for that.
And we hope that your wife is doing well. Mr. Truesdell.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Truesdell, and I am representing Ms. Sandra Green. The jury in this case found that the City of Austin retaliated against Ms. Green by engaging in 12 different acts of conduct because of her filing of EEOC grievances, and they took actions in retaliation. When she went to trial, she brought three claims: discrimination, harassment, and retaliation. And the jury found in favor of her on the retaliation claim, but against her on the discrimination and the harassment claim. And the jury awarded damages, back pay, compensatory, and then future compensatory, and attorney's fees. And the issue of attorney's fees was tried to the bench. The trial court granted a J&OV, striking two of those three categories of damages, and then cut the attorney's fees request by one-third. And we're here today because the court's rulings in those regards were incorrect and erroneous, and we'd just like to have those addressed. I'm going to start with the back pay issue, then talk about the compensatory, the statutory cap, and then the attorney's fees issue, and I'll get that all in 10 minutes, I promise. With respect to the J&OV on back pay, the city's argument starts off in opposition to our request by saying that the retaliation claim, or the findings of retaliation and the damages, did not relate to her retaliation claim, but they related to the discrimination or the harassment claim. And with all respect, that is incorrect. For the purposes of this case, this type of retaliation claim, Ms. Green had the burden to do certain things before she could bring a retaliation claim. She had to establish that she had a good faith, reasonable basis to believe that she had been discriminated against, or if she had been harassed. In other words, she had to make a good faith showing before she could establish a right to claim that she had engaged in protected activities that would be subject to a retaliation claim. And that's why the focus on the retaliation is independent of the discrimination and the retaliation, I mean harassment, but you have to show discrimination and harassment in order to bring the retaliation claim. It's important to note that the jury charge and case law makes clear that you don't have to prevail on a discrimination or a harassment claim in order to bring a retaliation claim. You just have to have it be able to show a protected activity, and that protected activity is based upon a showing of good faith. In other words, she had a burden at trial to establish that she had a good faith basis to bring those claims in order to pursue any claim for damages. And so for the focus, so the focus of a retaliation claim necessarily involves putting on proof of discrimination, putting on proof of harassment, because those were necessary prerequisites to establishing her back pay damages. The city also argues that Ms. Green had her pay raised during the course of the proceedings. From like in 2017, it went from one pay grade to another. But the problem with that is that the pay raise, first of all, was proactive and proactive only. She had been working at a level 10 employee from 2014 until the adjustments, but she was doing work at the level of a 20 or a 17 or a level 19 employee and was not paid for that. And the significant difference in the pay for a level 10 work that she was doing and level 19 work that she was doing, the level 10 work for which she was being paid. And so the fact that she did get a raise in 2017 doesn't remedy the fact that she went for that extended period of time with significant less compensation than she was entitled to based upon the work that she was performing. So the back pay issue really focuses on, it has to focus on not only the retaliation, but also on the other claims. And and the fact that she got a raise is really immaterial to the fact that she did suffer damages, and the damages are reflected by the jury's award of back pay damages.
Mr. Truesdell, let me ask you a question. Let me go back to the good faith claims. You say that your client, Ms. Green, had to show good faith claims in order to be able to get retaliation. Can you walk me a little bit through that? Because my understanding is, like you said, regardless of whether you win your discrimination and or harassment, you still have a right to bring a retaliation claim if what you were doing in complaining about those things was a protected activity. What do you mean that she had to show that she had a good faith claim in those two?
Yes, Your Honor. The explanation for that goes right to the point that you made about protected activity. And the protected activity means to establish that you had a protected activity, you have to establish that you had a good faith, reasonable belief that you were harassed or discriminated against. And you find that in the jury charge. Question 3 of the jury charge says that, now I need these back on. The employee need, and this is question 3, and it's at page 1403 of the record. Elsewhere, I'm sure as well, but it says that the employee need only establish a good faith, reasonable basis for their belief that the action complained of was discriminatory. And that the sentence that comes before that is opposition to a discriminatory employment practice is a protected activity, irrespective of the merits of the underlying discrimination claim. And so that's where I say that you have to show, that's how you get the protected activity, by showing that you had a good faith basis to assert discrimination.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that make sense? Okay, all right. So the primary purpose of the back pay is to remedy that situation. And
May I ask a follow-up question
there,
though? In terms of timing, the discriminatory action, are you suggesting that the back pay is to ameliorate the protected or the good faith belief, or the date after which there was retaliatory actions?
The retaliation obviously came after the discrimination.
Right.
And the point that I was making is that the retaliation came and how they tried to remedy the fact that she was underpaid.
In terms of calculating damages, though, are you suggesting that we need to go back to the alleged discriminatory action or the date at which the retaliatory action took place?
Okay, that's a good question, and I appreciate you asking that because you put that in a way better than I was when I was writing my notes. One of the arguments that was being made was that, and this was also in the trial court's findings of fact, which I'll get to in a minute because they're not appropriate, but one point that was made was that we're really just seeking to recoup fees for not getting a raise, or not getting a promotion back in 2015. And so they're saying that we're arguing that we should have got the fees for the promotion. And that's not necessarily correct. What we're saying is that when the city ultimately decided to reclassify her position in 2017, it made no accommodation for the fact that for 2016, part of 2017, 2015, she was getting paid at level 10 rather than at the higher level. And so the point I'm making is that the damages, if they are reflected by the delta between the salary received, the salary she should have earned, those go back. But the retaliation comes because when the city could remedy and decided to remedy those past actions, the retaliatory act was to not provide retroactive relief.
Okay. So you're asking this court, and I guess you previously asked the trial court, to calculate those back wages as a result of the discrimination?
Well, as a result of the retaliation.
Okay.
I want to make sure that I'm clear on that.
No,
but how are you bootstrapping back? So retaliation started after she brought the harassment and discrimination claim.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you, under the retaliation, how are you bootstrapping what she should have been paid between 2014 and 2017?
Okay, that's a very good question. The reason, oh my gosh.
That's okay.
The reason is that when the city decided to remedy the fact that she was underpaid for so long, it could have done two things. It could have retroactively paid her the amount that she was due for the past year's work that she performed, or it could make it prospective only. And by choosing to go prospective only, that was the act of retaliation. In other words,
Go ahead.
Oh yeah. Finish. In other words, the point is that the retaliation comes in what remedy the city tried to apply, and that was after the discrimination. So.
I have one more question.
Okay.
And calm down.
We're all good.
I know those things drive me crazy too.
I'm just glad they're colored because I can't see the numbers.
That's okay. So you alluded to the finding of facts, which we shouldn't look at. And I understand the argument is that there should have never been any finding of facts because this was a jury trial. But isn't it true that y'all are the ones who asked for the finding of facts?
We did, with respect to the attorney's fees issue, which they are appropriate for. And I will be the first to admit that. And I will not argue that this court should disregard the findings of facts and conclusions of law with respect to the attorney's fees. I think that this court should consider those. And in a next life, I will talk about the attorney's fees and those issues. But the point is, with respect to the JNOV, they're certainly not appropriate, regardless of whether we requested them. And the Linwood versus NCMB case expressly says, even if a party erroneously asks for them, and if a court erroneously grants them and issues them, they are to be disregarded. They carry no weight in the appellate court.
Any other questions?
No, thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Thank you. Mr.
Matula.
May it please the court. Context matters. Courts in statutory employment discrimination and retaliation cases have said for years, over and over and over, that minor annoyances, trivial harms, personality conflicts, and petty slights in the workplace that all employees experience from day to day are not materially adverse employment action for purposes of state and federal discrimination laws. That is what happened in this case. Question three that was presented to the jury gave a laundry list of what amounted to minor annoyances in the workplace under the guise of unlawful retaliatory action. And as the court is well aware, employment discrimination statutes regarding retaliation don't protect against all perceived retaliation. They were designed to protect against retaliation that produces injury or harm. That's from Burlington Northern Santa Fe versus White, Supreme Court 2006. And there's a reason for that, because as the courts have expressed for more than 20 years now, this is a subjective or an objective standard in determining what would dissuade a reasonable employee from bringing a charge of discrimination. That is what the retaliation statute is aimed at. And that standard is not always a fact issue to let the jury decide, and it's never been treated that way. The courts hold frequently that alleged actions, whether they be pled or whether they actually be tried to a jury or to a fact finder, they have repeatedly held that certain actions do not meet that objective standard. If the cases that the city cited in its opening brief give examples of the types of opinions that the courts have issued where they found this is not rise to that level, and the brief explains why that conclusion by a court, that there's no fact issue there, that's exactly what was being alleged with regard to question number three. Chief Justice Blacklock issued an opinion just last year on New Year's Eve. The court may be familiar with it. It's Texas Tech Health Science Center versus Flores. And the court's, Justice Blacklock's concurrence reminded everyone that these discrimination and retaliation laws should not be applied in a way that installs judges and juries as minders of ordinary personnel decisions. And that's what question three did. The mental states can be difficult to prove, Chief Justice Blacklock wrote, but difficulty of proof is no excuse for lack of proof. So to give the court an example of what was happening here, we look at the first part of question three. 3A. The question was, did Sandra Green's manager, Cesar Benavidez, allegedly evaluate her work performance in her annual SSPR as a member of a work group rather than individually in September of 2016? That was the question that the jury had before it. That was the answer. That was one of the 12 things that they said yes to. I filed yesterday an important document that I would like the court to review before any decision is reached in this that might help the court in some of the questions that I think might be on your mind with regard to the timing of these matters and how the discrimination theory correlated with the retaliation theory. And what this exhibit is, and it's tied to all of the trial exhibits, is it demonstrates that there was a six-month gap between the period of time that Ms. Green discovered that she didn't get that promotion she interviewed for in 2015 and the time that she filed her first EEOC charge. And let's make perfectly clear, question three specified the protected activity here was the filing of this series of EEOC charges. She didn't file the first one until May 5th of 2016. The undisputed evidence shows that Mr. Benavidez, who's the supervisor, who is the alleged person that did most of the things alleged in question three, he testified on the last day of trial. He didn't even find out that she had filed that EEOC charge until 2 or 3 months after. And as we pointed out in our brief, you can't just unhear that, and you can't disregard that, and you can't say, well, the jury chose to believe he was lying. You can't do that because the Mato v. Baldoff case demonstrate it is part of the plaintiff's burden in establishing the third element of a retaliation claim, that is a causal connection. It's the plaintiff's burden to prove that the person who did the thing was aware of the protected activity. And if Mr. Benavidez didn't know about the protected activity before the summer of 2017, then nothing that happened prior to that can legitimately be called retaliation for engaging in protected activity.
Okay, let me go back to numbers because I wrote something wrong. I thought you said the 6 month gap was 5/5/2016.
Let me clarify, Judge. The interviews were in August of 2015 for the promotion. The evidence was that Ms. Flores, the high scorer, was offered the job on November 13, 2015. Ms. Green claims she first learned that Flores got the job instead of her on November 23, 2015. Okay, so after that, Ms. Green filed internal complaints with her department and an internal grievance and an MCS.
Correct. So May of 2016 was her first EEOC.
That is correct.
You just said that he didn't find out till the summer of 2017.
I misspoke.
Okay, that I just wanted to make sure because that's a year later.
Yes.
So,
and I apologize for that mistake, and I would rely on the document that we filed with the court yesterday to clarify that the summer of 2016 is when Mr. Benavidez discovered that. So, back to question 3A. What the evidence showed on this is that this rating, it's like, did you do a group SSPR rating for the three members of the work group? The rating was fine. And Ms. Green testified she had no problem with the rating. It was commendable. And Mr. Benavidez told her that's a very good rating. Not only that, the group approach that Mr. Benavidez followed in giving this group of three employees in evaluating the work together, that's what he had done in the two previous performance review sessions. So what that shows is he was doing that before the protected activity ever happened. And no one ever complained about that. The complaint came by Ms. Green after the evaluation was done after she engaged in the protected activity. Well, the problem is you can't establish, number one, that that's a materially adverse action. There's case law that says getting a rating you don't like on a performance review is not a materially adverse action, especially when it's commendable. Secondarily, you can't establish causation because if the fact is Mr. Benavidez testified, and this is undisputed, that that's the same format he followed in the previous years. And no one rebutted that. And there's a great line in Chief Justice Blacklock's concurrence where he says, you know, that action may not have been square with Texas Tech's HR manual, but it wasn't illegal. And that's the real point of this. None of these actions amount to the rise to the level that a reasonable person would have chosen not to make a discrimination complaint. It certainly didn't deter Ms. Green. She filed a series of EEOC charges, which was her right. But I don't think that that issue is something that can be overlooked in the case because it goes to the jurisdiction. The cases that we've cited in our brief demonstrate, chiefly the San Antonio Water Systems versus Nicholas. When you're suing a governmental entity, you have to establish that in order for that governmental entity, like the City of Austin, to waive its immunity, you have to plead and prove at trial all three elements of retaliation claim. Element one, protected activity. We're not disputing that. Filing an EEOC charge, as you did in May 2016, that's a protected activity. The problem comes on the second element, where you suffered a materially adverse employment decision. And none of these 12 amount to that. Finally, with regard to some of these, and this is detailed in the brief, there is no evidence of causation. That's important because, as the courts keep emphasizing, the mental states can be difficult to prove, but the difficulty in proof is not an excuse for not proving it. This is important because this court is setting precedent. And interpreting these laws, it's important for employees and employers to understand, okay, if we do this, then that might be considered an adverse, materially adverse action for purposes of retaliation claim. We have to know going forward whether this is going to end up in a lawsuit in front of a jury. And so these are important questions, and that's why courts make these decisions. We moved for summary judgment and pleaded jurisdiction before trial on this exact same argument. We moved for directed verdict twice at trial on this exact same argument. We moved for JNOV after the verdict came back on this same argument. This cannot be waived. This is a jurisdictional matter. Secondarily, with regard to the jury charge, and there was a piece of the jury charge that's been briefed extensively. There was a question that was just wrong. It had an error in it. And I admit, I wasn't in the room at the time of the charge conference. And I think Mr. Spencer was, and my co-counsel was here today. They were in the room. And I've read the transcript many times. But he's correct. We did not say, no, that question can't come in because that should say 2016 and 2015. That wasn't said on the record. But what was said on the record repeatedly by Mr. Mickel was that Alamo Heights Independent School District versus Clark sets a standard, and this stuff doesn't rise to the level of materially adverse action. The point I'm trying to make is this. No, we did not object to the question as worded during the charge conference. But the distinction here is when the jury found, hey, there's something wrong with this question, and they sent the note out, Judge Mosley brought the lawyers in and said, what is this? And I think it's pretty clear from the record that Mr. Bledsoe said, well, it shouldn't say 2015, it should say 2016. They missed it, we missed it. That's not the point. The point is the court had the opportunity to fix what was clearly an error. Because as this timeline demonstrates, Mr. Benavidez couldn't have retaliated against Ms. Green prior to learning about her protected activity in the summer of 2016. And this question said, oh, no, you can go back to 2015. That was the problem. That's why I suggested let's take that question out because there's no way to fix the question. And the court said, no, I'm gonna send instructions back and tell them to answer the flawed question. That is a question that everybody knew was flawed. That's what we had. And the jury answered yes to it, so there's the harm. Finally, with regard to the compensatory damages claim, the issue there is fairly straightforward. The evidence offered did not rise to the level to substantiate a maximum award of $300,000 for mental anguish. There weren't any evidence of any other aspect of her past compensatory damages offered. They're trying to say now, oh no, there was other stuff. The brief goes through each element in the question, says there was no evidence regarding this. Briefly, if I have any time, I would like to address the arguments that were raised. The argument regarding the damages. Judge Mosley on the JNOV issued rulings striking the future compensatory and back pay, and the judge explained her reasons. We had a lengthy hearing about that. After the hearing, and we argued attorney fees at the same time, after the hearing, plaintiff's counsel sent a notice to Judge Mosley saying, we request findings of fact and conclusions of law. And in all due respect, counsel, he wasn't fully telling the court that request for findings and conclusions, it didn't distinguish. It didn't say, we only want findings on attorney's fees, or we only want findings on Jane. It just said, we want findings and conclusions. Judge Mosley responded with a letter and said, okay, counsel, I want you both to submit proposed findings and conclusions with regard both to attorney's fees and the JNOV ruling. And she explains her reason in a letter that's part of the record. The plaintiff didn't object to that. The plaintiff wrote their own proposed findings and conclusions. And among those were lots of findings and conclusions regarding the JNOV issue. So to stand up, Justice Triana, and tell you today that, well, you can't pay any attention to them because they're inappropriate. They asked for them. Not only that, they wrote some of them. And the case law that they cited in their brief, I know, I've read it, it says that you shouldn't ask for them, but they did ask for them. And the judge issued them. And I think it is very poor jurisprudence for any court to ignore any finding and conclusion written by any judge. This court has to decide what weight to give those findings and conclusions. But to read them out and pretend they're not there would be a mistake.
Well, let me ask you about the case that Mr. Truesdell was citing to in his argument that even if you ask, that stands for the proposition, that even if you ask for findings of facts and conclusions of law and they're given and it's erroneous, the asking and the giving, that it doesn't matter, that we don't have the we can't look at them.
My response to that would be, I didn't see that case in his brief, and he said it real quickly. I'll try to write it down next time, but I think the distinction is, in this case, is the party complaining about the findings and conclusions. That was the party asking for them. So I'd be happy to write a post-argument brief to the court if I understand what the name of that case is, and I'll read that case and make sure that distinction is clear. But I think it's an important distinction. I think the argument isn't, well, they're wrong. You shouldn't read them or pay any attention to them because they're wrong. I think the argument is, well, they're inappropriate and shows you should blind yourself to them and not read them, which I believe would be a mistake. Finally, with regard to his claim about back pay, the court can read all about the back pay testimony in the record. It's 42 pages long. It takes less than 2 minutes to read the entire testimony about all of her damages. The problem with the back pay is, she was asked on direct examination by Mr. Bledsoe, you're asking for back pay? Yes. How much? $75,000, period. No explanation, no nothing. The problem is the back pay, that is tied to the discrimination complaint. That is, I should have gotten the job in 2015 that I interviewed for and didn't. There was no alternative back pay calculation or theory provided to the jury.
Well, let me ask you that, just follow up on that issue. Is there any authority that would allow the court to calculate, to your knowledge, back pay if there's a jury finding just to retaliation, whether the court can go back and compensate for the difference in wages before the date of retaliation?
Not under this record. I'm not familiar with that authority, Your Honor, but I can tell you under this record, the problem is it's just not in the record, because the testimony that you can read for yourself, it's a number, not supported by anything.
Right, and I understand, and I know where you're looking in the record, but are you aware of any cases that have done that?
As I stand here today, I am not here.
Okay, thank you.
I see I'm getting a red light.
Okay. I have one question.
Go right ahead.
With respect to the jury charge issue, what does the city believe to be the proper remedy for the error in the charge?
For the error, okay, let me make sure I understand.
Right.
The error simply with regard to 3L, which was the question with the bungalow.
Date.
You're in it. Is that the question?
Yes.
Okay. I believe the appropriate remedy for that would be to, let me make sure I'm clear on this. We do not believe that that matter, as expressed in 3L, amounts to a materially adverse action for purposes of the second element of retaliation claim.
Okay.
If the court disagrees with me and says, oh no, that's an adverse personnel action, then I think the appropriate remedy would be to remand the case back for a trial on that, because the jury just had the wrong number. And the question permitted the jury to say, let's think about all the stuff that happened prior to her EEOC charges and factor that in. So that did that answer the question?
You believe it's harmful error, and if the remand and retrial would be?
If that is the only problem that the court had with any part of question three was just that one discrete section that had the wrong year in there, then I think the remand would be the appropriate remedy for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Mr. Truesdell, you'll have 10 minutes. I'm going to ask you to give me the site of the case.
The Linwood?
Tell me.
Linwood versus NCNB?
Do you have...
I'm going to pull up my... Your Honor, I'll figure out the brief inside of the Linwood.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Well, while I look for that, the other case that says the exact same thing is IKV. Industries versus Proline Corp, and that is at 938-440. I think Linwood's just a more recent one, but it's edged the same proposition.
440. Correct, Southwest 3rd.
Southwest 2nd, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
2nd, you said?
Yes.
That's the IKV. That's cited in our briefs at 13, 17, 19, and 27.
Okay, thank you.
If question 3L said, instead of saying, if question 3L said, did these acts occur from the beginning of time through 2017, it would make no difference to what happened here. Because what happened, because the jury simply could not find, there was no conduct that occurred before before the EEOC filing that was dated the date of, there was no conduct that occurred before the EEOC filing. So it doesn't really matter if it said 2015, 2016, or 2017. That is an absolute red herring with respect to the claim here. The charge could have said from the beginning of time, there's just no conduct that occurred after the 20, because the charge itself, the second part of question 3L says, anything after, do you find anything after the filing of the EEOC complaint? So that's a benchmark that is included in the question itself. In other words, let me, I'm so sorry. The actions, if any, which which allegedly isolated Sandra Green from her coworkers between 2015 and 2017. Okay, but the precursor to that entire question, did the city of Austin take the following employment actions because of her filing of EEOC charges of discrimination against the city of Austin? To the extent that those filings were not made until 2016, the only conduct that a jury could use to issue a yes answer to 3L would have been conduct that occurred after 2016. So it doesn't really matter if it says 2015 or if it said 2000 or whatever. There's no conduct that the jury could have found. More importantly, the city has not pointed to any evidence in the record that they say, you know, because of that 2015 reference, they may have based this decision on this instead. Most importantly, though, is that for the 3L issue to make any difference to this court whatsoever, it would also have to find that the other 11 grounds to which the jury answered yes were incorrectly decided. Because if it doesn't, then the jury's answers to question number 4, which are the damage questions, could be independently sustained based upon the conduct that was found in the 11 other things that the jury answered yes to. This is just one of 12 that was answered yes to. And so to focus on a technicality within that charge really provides no relief to the city because it is harmless error, if there is any error.
Well, can we focus a little bit on the materially adverse employment action?
Of course.
Action? So will you direct us to where in the record that we would find evidentiary support for conduct that meets that threshold?
Your Honor, what I would say in that regard, let me take one step back. What I would say with respect to that is that the city's reliance upon the City of San Antonio versus Nicholas case is a little bit misleading. And it's misleading because while Nicholas talks about the need for materially adverse, it sets it up in the manner that says that you determine that by using an objective and a subjective standard, and they're measured by the employee, not anybody else.
Okay.
The employee. And so my simple point is that with respect to determining materially adverse, it is up to the employee to determine that. And more importantly, question 3 doesn't say materially adverse. It says, did the city take an adverse employment action?
But that's the standard by which we must evaluate the evidence, correct?
You have to evaluate the evidence by the basis of the charge. The city of Fort Worth versus Imlich says you do what the charge says. Now, the city didn't, there's no objection in the record to the charge conference where it said, question three should say, you know, there's no tender, there's no objection, there's no ruling on an objection that says, Your Honor, they put the trial judge in an awkward spot here because the trial judge issued the question that was asked of them. It went through the charge conference. It doesn't say, you know, do you find a materially adverse thing? And then this is the definition of materially adverse. It says, do you find that the city took employment action, adverse employment action, because of Ms. Green's filing of the EEOC complaints? So my point is with respect to the materially adverse, for those purposes, materially adverse is not what the question asked the court, not what the jury asked, was jury was asked to find.
Mr. Truesdale, may I ask, do you agree with your friend on the other side that the immunity issue is a jurisdictional one and therefore cannot be waived?
Your Honor, I do, but here's the kicker. If we lose on the merits, we lose on jurisdiction. If we win on the merits, we win on jurisdiction. So it's like the old days. Should a petition or a writ of error be denied, or should it be dismissed for want of jurisdiction because the case isn't important to the jurisdiction of the state? I mean, it's one and the same. I don't see how you could satisfy a prima facie case and prevail in the jury without also satisfying the materiality issue. Does that make sense, the distinction there? Because the point is that it's six of one, half a dozen the other. If you lose on the merits, you're not going to have materiality and the court would lose jurisdiction. If you win on the merits, the court has jurisdiction. So.
Well, you agree, though, that jurisdiction is something this court has to look at on its own.
Yes, of course, without question. But if you're going to rule against me on jurisdiction, it's because I lost on the merits. Because the only way I would lose on jurisdiction is if I didn't prove the merits.
Before we run out of time, let me ask you, a question related to the damage calculation. I know there's a portion of the testimony of Ms. Green wherein she reflects on the $75,000 back pay. How do we, what in the record would support an award of back damages or even specifically related to the benefits calculations that exceed $75,000?
Sure. That's, yes, Your Honor. And the way we do that is we look at the definition of back pay, because the definition of back pay includes more than just wages, okay? The testimony, the eight lines of testimony that they cite has to do with her request for wages. Now, there's other testimony in the record that addresses other types of benefits or elements of the back pay issue throughout, including lost other benefits. And if I can grab my note, I will tell you that it is... I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. She has testimony about the difference between back pay, between the time when she started work and then when she was only prospectively remedied for that. There's testimony regarding other missed benefits, and if you could turn to page 6RR36 of the record, there's testimony about $205,000 in other damages, including missed benefits. And those accumulate with the $75,000 in other ones to reach the $300,000 that the jury actually found. So I would refer this court to page 36 of
the record.
Reporter Record volume 6.
Thank you.
If I can have 2 seconds to switch gears and address one issue that I was going to talk about, and that is the attorney's fees issue. That we had raised earlier. The court reduced the attorney's fees by 65%. There's no question. One third. The city says, well, we don't know that the court did that. They did it to, it might be a coincidence that they were 0.1 decimal point away from a one third reduction, but it looks like that's what they did. The point is, the court did not engage in the lodestar analysis that a trial court is required to do. And we know that because if you look at the findings of fact, and I invite this court to look at those, the findings of fact that the court cites, you know, they say 73, conclusional law. This describes the steps that a court must engage in the lodestar analysis. But what follows is not an analysis of that. What is missing from the findings of fact or conclusions of law is any analysis about what the steps are. What were the rates? What was the baseline rate? What was the appropriate number of hours? How do we multiply those together to get the base rate? Once we find that, then we can decide, should it go up or should it go down? The court simply did not do that. Court then says we did not engage, rely only on a lodestar. But it doesn't say what it did rely upon to reduce its rates at all. And so I invite the court to study the conclusions of law 72 through 75, because when they do, it's clear that a lodestar analysis was not conducted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Matula, five minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to make three things clear in my 5 minutes. Question 3L issue about 2015. The way I understood the issue is, yeah, it's wrong, but so what? The jury figured it out. They were really smart. Frankly, the law requires more from the lawyers preparing the charge and from the court typing the charge than, well, it's pretty close. The jury will figure this all out. To your question, Justice Crump, about what evidence is there in the record of stuff prior to 2015, we direct the court to that evidence in our opening brief. And that evidence is, after Ms. Green didn't get that promotion in 2015, that's when the work atmosphere became, and the word they used was toxic. And Ms. Green said she contributed to that because she didn't want to talk to Mr. Benavidez or Ms. Valdivieso. That was way before the 2016 EEOC charge. Number two, I'm heartened that counsel agreed that this is a jurisdictional matter. I think the courts all agree with that. That is the argument we've made in the summary judgment and throughout the case. With regard to the damages in this case, Justice Crump, the question you were asking, that reminded me of the hearing that we had on the JNOV motion for Judge Mazzi years ago. Because if you read the transcript, you'll get the impression Judge Mazzi was struggling with that. She kept asking Mr. Bledsoe, what are the damages? Where is the evidence of damages? Mr. Bledsoe's answer to that was, well, that $646,000 that they called lost front retirement, his explanation in the record, volume 8, page 53, was, well, what the jury did was they took that big number and they split it arbitrarily between the back pay and future compensatory damages. And if you read the charge, the jury was told, don't do that. Don't include pay in compensatory damages. But that was the question that the judge asked, and that was the explanation that was given by counsel. Finally, with regard to the attorney's fees issue, what the court did was issued a ruling finding attorney's fees of 48% of the damages that were awarded in the judgment. 48% of the damages. Their standard of review on this is abuse of discretion. There is nothing arbitrary or ambiguous, nothing arbitrary or untied to legal authority to award 48%, an amount that's 48% of the damages. If Judge Mazzi had said, no, I'm going to give you exactly the amount you're asking for, that would have been 50% more in attorney's fees than were awarded in damages. And keep in mind, and this is in the findings and conclusions, the judge found most of the time during this trial was spent on the issue of the discrimination complaint, the witnesses, the score sheets, the interviewing. And the jury said, no, that's not. There was nothing unlawful there. There's nothing discriminatory. There's no unlawful harassment. They lost two out of their three claims. But there was no means, and the record reveals this, to differentiate between any efforts focused on those two lost claims and then the claim that they did prevail on. Finally, the court can't help but notice the evidence regarding attorney's fees. It's 70 pages of a trial transcript at the hearing that we had after the trial. The evidence regarding the damages is a page and a half of the trial transcript. That was the information the jury was given to go back in there and come up with some numbers. The law is clear. You can't pull a number out of a hat. You have to give the jury evidence. And when it comes to economic damages, those related to pay, you have to give them some method of calculating the amount, and they just didn't do that.
They certainly didn't do it to distinguish between the discrimination cause of action and the retaliation cause of action. They didn't give them any of that. They just gave them a hat and said, good luck. That is not the law. It has never been the law. Some evidence must be provided to prove both mental anguish damages as well as economic damages related to pay. You can't rush through that, and that's what happened in this case, and the evidence is just not there, and counsel hasn't directed this court to any evidence to substantiate it. The brief consists of speculation. Well, if you do this and do this math and add this, and that's not in the record. That's not what the jury was asked to do. That's not what any witness explained to them. That's not what counsel asked them to do in closing argument. That's just not in the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. At this time, then, we are going to submit 032430CV, Sandra Green Appellant versus City of Austin, Appellee, and Cross Appellant, City of Austin versus Sandra Green, Cross Appellee. Thank you all very much.